Wrestling, the only wicked good wrestling podcast out there. Give us 60 minutes and we'll give you a cool wrestling podcast. My name is John McAdam, and I'm here with my co-host, Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you today?
Just outstanding. But you know what? We only have an hour here, and let's get to the wrestling portion of our programming. And we have a special guest today.
Yes, we do. First of all, let me tell you guys what's going on. I got the idea maybe a month ago to do like something year end, but I couldn't figure out what, because no one's going to want to hear a show that, you know, reminisces about wrestling in 2018, or at least not our audience. But I came up with the idea like last week. I'm like, let's do the Stickies, which will be our annual awards program, and we'll just go back in time and do best of the 1980s. And joining Sean and I today is someone who I've been friends with for over 20 years. He's a really cool guy, and he will kick your ass at hockey, Brad Breachman. Brad, how are you?
I'm well. I'm well. Thank you for having me on. It's an honor. It's Breachman. But everyone gets
that. So I've been saying it wrong for 20 years. Is that what you're telling me?
Well, people usually called me just Weasel Suit for a long time.
True.
So I understand.
Yeah, so anyway, the premise of this show is that we are going to pick various awards that Dave Meltzer had in the Wrestling Observer yearbook over the years. And instead of doing, let's say, best heel of the year, we'll do best heel of the decade of the 1980s. And Brad, because you are our guest, I'm going to let you select which category you would like us to discuss first.
Okay, I can do that. First of all, I just have to preface really quickly by saying that I went to my first wrestling show live in August of 1981, and I tapped out on wrestling sometime in late 88. So there may be a gap or two in my judgment, but the last thing I remember doing for wrestling was writing the Brody obituary for the Pro Wrestling Torch, and that was 88. Anyway, I'd like to start off with doing maybe something a little bit curveball. I got most underrated, and I've got a few guys here, first of which is Len Denton in both the grappler and the dirty white boy gimmick that they worked. I think that Len Denton was very underrated. Everything I've seen of him has been rock solid. I got the Irwin brothers, both Scott and his brother, the Irwin brothers. Mike Graham, another guy who, if he'd been 6 inches taller, would have been a huge deal all over the place. I saw him work a couple times with Buck Zumhoff here in St. Paul and in Bloomington in Minnesota here. And he was tremendous. He carried Buck to a great match, which is, of course, needed. And also my last one being Buddy Roberts of the Freebirds, who worked so very hard every time he went out. Yeah, so that's my most underrated category.
All right, well, I'll tell you what. I am in complete agreement with you strongly on three of them. I saw the grappler when he was North American champion down in Wattsland. Like this is middle of 1980, and I totally bought him as a main eventer. I think he could have done a lot more than he actually did, so I agree with you. The Irwins, I think if Scott had not gotten sick, I think they had finally found the right gimmick. Not the Super Destroyers, but the what were they?
Long Riders.
Thank you, the Long Riders. And I think had Scott not gotten sick, they absolutely would have been part of the tag team scene in either probably WWF or WCW. And I think really I could see a world where they were WWF tag team champions.
Yeah, I think so too.
Mike Graham. We're back to me early 80s cable. I was convinced that he had an outside chance of being the NWA champion. That is high praise. And one of the best matches I've ever seen was they did something called an Australian rules match with him and Dory Funk Jr. This is, I want to say, spring of 1981, and it was like a 4.5-star match.
Yeah, great worker.
I like Mike more for the 70s than I do the 80s. But yeah, he's definitely the one you named that I didn't even think of, and I should have, was Len Denton. He's tremendous. He's everywhere he goes, and the Irwins too. I mean, there's something to be said for never really being bad, you know, just always being good. Yeah. Like, they were consistently good performers, no matter where they were. Whether I saw them a lot in Georgia, and I saw them a lot in as the Long Riders, which who I like too, in Dallas.
Well, that's the thing. A lot of people talk about, you know, what this wrestler, oh, he was good, he was not good. The reality is, a lot of the time, a wrestler is really good in his prime, and then he, you know, he either stunk at the beginning of his career when he was just getting started, or he stunk at the end of his career due to age and injuries, or more likely, he stunk because he went to the WWF.
Yeah. Yeah, it didn't do much for a lot of the guys' work rate, as we say. Crazy schedules.
And if you don't have to kill yourself, if you don't have to kill yourself, why kill yourself?
Exactly.
You know, it was the travel, and I you know, spoke to one of the WWF wrestlers, you know, a long time ago, and he felt like it wasn't his job to go out there and put on entertaining matches. His job was to get to the arena, in and out of the arena in one piece, and not get injured.
Yep, exactly. Mm-hmm. And when the WWF started to run here in Minneapolis, or Bloomington, I guess it is, it only took me two shows to go to figure out that these guys are just going through the motions, and I was done with that.
Yeah.
Those crazy schedules are real killers for those guys. I've heard just ridiculous stories.
Oh, yeah, I mean, you hear the stories. Guys wake up, they're like, okay, where am I? What city am I in right now? And they have no idea.
Yep.
So, Sean, share your thoughts about who might be the most underrated wrestler of the decade of the 1980s.
I like the Len Denton answer. I didn't even think of that, but that's a really good answer. I still like mine. Billy Dundee.
That's a good one.
Yep.
I would say I would have him as a top five wrestler in 1986. He was outstanding in 1983 when he had the Great Loser Leave Town match. He was one of the guys who kept him afloat in 1980 on the babyface side when Lawler got hurt. He was fantastic. 1981. He was great as a booker in Mid-South. And he was always good. I mean, he's just one of these guys, week in, week out, you know what you're going to get out of Billy Dundee.
I don't know if you guys remember this. Remember when Bill Dundee and Buddy Landell showed up? I think this was August 1986 on WTBS. It really looked like that act was set to just take off, and it was going to be something fresh and new, and of course Buddy turned back into Buddy, and it never happened.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if I remember. Did you say 88?
This was 86, like right 86. After the Great American Bash they showed up.
I don't have a recollection of that. I'm not familiar with that. I don't recall that. Even though I was watching every week, I just – some of the things after the years, I'm getting old. So.
Nah, that's okay. I mean, you know what? They were in and out. I think Buddy was gone by September, if not October. And Bill just kind of lingered around and eventually went back to Memphis.
Right. It was about a 20-day window when they Buddy Landell had world championship prospects going on. So I thought he – was always good. He was just always fantastic. I know he was undersized, but and he's the only one who could actually pull off a watchable scaffold match.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen Buddy Landell up on that scaffold. The guy is fearless. It was almost like he was daring the scaffold. You know, okay, I dare you to have me fall off this thing.
He always liked to fire into Lawler, which is fantastic because, you know, just Lawler. And you know, it's just – and he has good chemistry with almost everybody. I mean, I can't think of a bad Bill Dundee match. I can think of ones that aren't great, but I can't think of a bad one.
And he was really good on the stick.
Yeah, Dundee is an excellent choice.
All right. Mine would be I went with the Irwins. I agreed with that. I think they could have been a major – star on the tag team scene. The other one I'm going with is Chavo and Hector Guerrero. To this day, I have no idea why they were not superstars, if not in the WWF, in JCP. I think they would have been naturals to come in as heels and feud with the Rock and Roll Express, kind of like they did briefly in Mid-South. And everyone turned in JCP, so they would eventually turn babyface. And what a feud they would have had against the Midnight Express.
I have a weird theory about that. These guys. I think that when you bring them in, you just think they're so good that there's no backstory necessary, and they struggle right out of the gate. This happened in Memphis. They came in; it was a kind of a, you know, they looked great promos, but they really had nothing to do. because I just think they, you know, they have such a great reputation that sometimes the guys don't think of something for them to do, and they kind of stumble right out of the gate.
I can see that. But, you know, in late 83 or early 84, Hector came out with the idea to turn heel in Florida and come out in the sombrero and the bandoleros, you know, looking like the bad guys from a Clint Eastwood movie. And it worked. And I think that would have been big in the WWF. They were a little bit undersized, but I'll tell you what, if people in Louisiana bought Hector Guerrero or Ricky Morton throwing around Steve Williams, they would have believed it in the WWF, and especially JCP.
Yeah, I think so too.
Definitely. All right, Sean, it's your turn. You get to pick a category. Discuss best or worst of the 80s.
Oh, you're killing me with this out of order thing. So John gave us about 500 categories. We'll go with the feud of the decade.
All right. Brad, what do you think?
Sean,
you brought it up. I have to give it to you first. I'm sorry.
Yep. I would say Ricky and Jay versus Sergeant Dawn. Perfect feud. See, now I asked you a question about this. Now, if you're going to tell me like the biggest moneymaker, this is just my personal. I think the feud was brilliant. The way it was put together, the way it was, you know, the way the storyline carried out, you really felt they hate each other. And my favorite part, and I brought this up before here, they had this one little moment where they both had these massive fines going into the final match.
Mm-hmm.
And you remember they had to have Jack Briscoe and the rest of the guys gather the money together to pay for them. And it just kind of put over the tag team belts because it showed that, wait, Sergeant Dawn can actually, you know, pay for the fine without help because of the champs.
Sure. Certainly.
It's a great way of putting over your tag belts. And it just it just kind of elevated both of them. It elevated the championship. And it was always about the belt. It just kind of spiraled out of control, but it was always about the belts. I thought it was a fantastic feud. Just well done all around.
And I agree. That was an outstanding touch.
Yeah, for sure. I agree as well.
All right, Brad, best feud of the 80s. What do you got?
Well, he had to pick one that I left blank, but as I just went into panic mode, I think I picked mine out. It's going to be maybe come off a little bit strange, and I can kind of explain where I'm coming from, or you may know where it might know right away. I've got Hogan Heenan.
Hogan and Heenan. I thought you were going to say Hogan and Bockwinkel.
Well,
but
I would
Hogan
say
and Heenan makes sense.
Yeah, Hogan. You know, with Heenan and the fact that all that Andre had to do to turn heel was walk out with Heenan and be seen with him. And just through all Heenan from 81 in the AWA, the late 81 when Hogan, they decided he was going to be a babyface, all the way through the decade, Heenan just kept, you know, coming back with more challengers as they went to New York. And then, of course, you know, he had Bockwinkel here in AWA and they had some great matches. But I'm just going to say Hogan Heenan because it was just – there was always heat when they were the two of them were involved, and it was huge. And you know, the Andre the Giant match, of course. But yeah, that's my feud of the decade: Hogan versus Heenan and Heenan's family.
The more I think about this, that is one heck of a choice.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's a very good choice because I actually had you marked down for Henning Bockwinkel, but that's a great way to put it because Hogan, all his feuds were, you know, they were okay individually, but if you have Heenan as an umbrella.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, that makes perfect sense. That.
Yes. I mean, after they went to New York, I mean, just about everyone that Hogan was working with, be it a short program, long program, Heenan was involved with most of those.
Yeah. Who else is getting Bundy over?
Yeah. That's right.
And, you know, and I agree. I mean, not only was Hogan versus Heenan, it wasn't just Hogan versus Bockwinkel. It was Hogan versus Patera, Duncan, et cetera. And then they brought it to the WWF, and it was the most natural thing in the world. Like you guys said, with Andre, Stud and Bundy, Patera, the more I think about this, that is an excellent choice, man.
I believe Bobby hated him. It was one of those things where there was no suspect. I believe Bobby in his heart hated him.
Yeah, he was obsessed with Hogan's demise.
Yep. We don't want to talk about the 90s here, I know. But, you know, into the 90s, even when Hogan turned, just quickly, when Hogan turned, Heenan was still like, I told you so.
Yep, absolutely. It went by. I to this, even when I, like, even when the kayfabe was gone, everything, I still believe Bobby hated Hogan. That's how well he put that over.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
All right. My pick, I'm going to give you two. I'm going to give my personal favorite, which was Ric Flair against Ricky Steamboat in 1989. But to me, Feud of the Decade is the one where we did a three-part analysis, a three-show analysis of, which was the Von Erichs versus the Freebirds. It took a struggling territory. I can't really say struggling because the Kerry versus Flair match did really well in 1982, but nothing else did. And it put World Class on the map to the point where they were drawing $100,000 houses forever. And the feud lasted a good like 20 to 21 months. And I thought they brought it back a little bit too early. But it was the feud that put a promotion on the map.
Yeah, it was red hot. If anything, I think I would like to have seen the Freebirds get a little more heat on the Von Erichs, even though they did. But they were, I mean, the TV show became a little bit stagnant to me because, you know, it was always the Von Erichs would, you know, the go carry go and this and that and the other thing. And they would, they just didn't seem like, you know, slamming the head in the cage, the door, things like that. When Mike came out and they started working with them, it was just cringeworthy to me, but that was a great feud. That was huge money.
At its peak, it was very short, but yeah. It was – but it's – okay. Maya, do you guys remember the Rock and Roll Magazine Cream?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
My answer was the Cream answer. The Lester Bangs answer was the I'm going to give a different answer just to be difficult. But, yes, your answer is the correct answer. It's the, yeah. I mean, there was nothing like it when it was on. I mean, in that way, you were getting repercussions for that in Boston.
I can't believe the three of us used to read Cream magazine, but anyway. All right, I am going to pick a category, and I just want to underline this. Like, mine's going to be a worst category, and it's nothing personal, okay? It's just, you know, this is how I'm evaluating a performer. If you're this guy's best friend, I'm sorry. Like I said, nothing personal. Worst manager of the decade. Now, there were some bad ones, and as a matter of fact, in The Observer – excuse me – Mr. Fuji has this award named after him. I don't think Fuji, I mean, he wasn't good. I'll go as far as to say he was bad. But to me, he was just another WWF manager, and it didn't really matter. You know, he was just about as bad as, like, Johnny Valiant. And like I said, it didn't matter. He was managing middle-of-the-card guys. My worst manager of the decade is Hiro Matsuda. They brought him in to replace J.J. Dillon at the end of 1988 when Dillon scampered to the WWF and worked the front office. And they put him out there with Barry Windham and Ric Flair. And you may have well put your two top heels, have them managed by the Invisible Man. He couldn't do interviews, and the whole premise was that we're so angry – are supposed to be so angry at Japanese businessmen and their impact on the United States economy. It was every bit as entertaining as I just made it sound.
Agreed. Agreed.
All right. Brad, who do you got?
Well, you kind of put a needle in my balloon a little bit because you did mention this guy in passing. My worst manager of the decade is Johnny Valiant. When Hogan first came into the AWA and they started on TV in the mid-1981 summertime, they wanted him to be a heel. And they put him with Johnny Valiant. And Johnny Valiant came out and did interviews for 2 or 3 weeks without Hogan to kind of hype him coming in because they really wanted to – I don't know what they were trying to do. I think they were trying to set something up with Bockwinkel turning at that time, but I'm not sure. That's just a theory I have. But Johnny Valiant was horrible, and he was in when Hogan finally did show up, and my first show I ever saw, incidentally, unfortuitously for me, you know, some ways was Hogan's first shot in Minneapolis in August of 81. That was my first show where he defeated three jobbers. But Johnny Valiant was horrible in that case, and they got rid of him quickly. And then when he went to the WWF, it was, you know, it was ridiculous. He just wasn't good.
Sean, what's your pick?
I'm changing my answer. I had Paul Jones. I'm incorrect. Brad is correct. I and this is personal. I know, you know, RIP just passed away. Okay. I hate it. Okay. You know who Johnny was? Do you remember Bill Murray in the lounge singer on Saturday Night Live?
Jerry Aldini.
That is Johnny Valiant.
Yeah.
I saw one time that he was doing like some live stand-up show, and I thought of the scene with like Jake LaMotta at the end of the Raging Bull, you know, where he's sitting there reciting Shakespeare. I mean, oh, he's so bad. And I saw him once in Memphis. Picture that act in Memphis. It looked strange. It just, it didn't, like, even Hogan looked more in place in Memphis than Johnny Valiant did. Just absolutely horrible. He basically rode Jimmy's coattails forever.
Even with Memphis Magic, I don't think that would have worked either. No, it would have been ridiculous.
I mean, his interviews were so bizarre that they were sometimes entertaining because you're like, what is this guy talking about? But yeah, like I said, I mean, if I say, you know, that someone's every bit as bad as Mr. Fuji, you better believe he's bad.
Do you think it's possible that Andy Kaufman based his alter ego on Johnny Valiant? Do you remember that little alter ego? Possible. The little alter ego he had, the fat guy with the mustache and the cigar?
Tony.
Yeah,
him. Tony Clifton.
And he did watch a lot of wrestling.
He did. You know what? Tony Clifton reminds me of Johnny Valiant. I think you're onto something there.
Yeah, he would have been watching Valiant in the 70s when he came up with that character.
Yeah.
Another mystery solved.
I'll tell you what, it definitely wasn't Johnny Valiant trying to do Tony, what's his name? Tony Clifton.
It wasn't Johnny Valiant trying to be entertaining. I know that because that's never happened. So, yeah, no, he should be given 20% of everything he made to Jimmy.
You see, this is what we're talking about. It's not personal. I met Johnny Valiant. I thought he was a great guy. I mean, he is pretty much what he shows up on TV. No, he is that guy. But he wasn't a bad guy. He's just a bad manager.
Yeah, three answers here that are personal. That's one.
All right. Well, round two, Brad, what would you like to discuss?
Well, I want to keep it negative here. So,
all right.
Yeah, well, you know. This is a guy – I'm going to do most embarrassing wrestler of the decade. And this is more of an embarrassing gimmick. And this is a guy that I champion, and I've gotten into it with people, not giving him credit for how hard he worked and how he busted his ass and he just wasn't able to build a physique. But I certainly can't do anything about the Rambo Greg Gagne situation. I can't. Ooh. I can't have no argument for Rambo Greg Gagne, and that was completely embarrassing with him in the army fatigues and the camouflage and the headband and the, you know, yeah, that was as bad as it got for me, and that's saying something with some of the stuff they were doing in the WWF. But Rambo Greg Gagne is the most embarrassing wrestling gimmick anyway of the decade.
That is a good one. We used to get AWA television on WPIX on cable, and I remember when they came out with that gimmick. It was more than it was a bad gimmick. It was a bad fit for Greg, but it made it look like the AWA was just like, okay, we're going to be the WWF now, and it's going to work.
Yeah, it didn't.
No, it definitely didn't. All right. Sean, any thoughts on your worst gimmick of the decade?
I like Brad's answer again, but I was going to go with Dewey Robinson as the missing link. I was either going between him or Kamala. I'm trying to think of if you're watching wrestling with someone who doesn't watch wrestling and this character appears, you're getting a look, you know, like, seriously, defend this, please. You know, you're getting that look. Yeah. The missing link is one of those guys, and Kamala's another.
It's kind of like the look I'm getting from my wife across the room as I'm recording this here with you.
Yes, I could see the similarities.
Enjoying this.
Yes.
Enjoying
Tell her I said hi.
Hello.
My gimmick, worst gimmick, predates all of those gimmicks because by the time the missing link came out, it wasn't that dumb. Well, it was, but you know what I mean, like compared to the other stuff
that
WWF was doing. Greg Gagne is Rambo, at least you could see what they were trying to do.
Yeah.
When the Moondogs first showed up in the WWF, okay, you've got these guys who are acting like dogs. And the WWF was kind of a gimmick territory. At the same time, they had George Steele and Killer Khan. So, you know, we've got our geek quota filled. but the Moondogs just way outshined them in terms of everything. I was just so embarrassed to be a wrestling fan when they were on.
This is basically all the same answer. I mean, it's the – or you could put Hillbilly Jim. That's another one. When Vince had one of his little hillbilly, you know, fetish things going on. Mm-hmm. You know, any one of those. But, yeah, it's the same – basically the same answer. I mean, my guy's – you know, the guy I picked is named after an archaeological, you know, gap. So, I mean, it's one of those things where you're, like, picturing, like, okay, how did he get past the Athletic Commission?
Well, you know what? I got to say, Dave did not put out best or worst archaeological gap, because I would have been considering that one as one of my picks.
I mean, the New York Athletic Commission is still mad at the Bruiser, but Kamala, that's okay. We don't mind the cannibal.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess Outback Jack dodged a bullet there.
Oh, Steve, poor Stevie Kern. Oh, what happened there?
That was 90s, but yeah, and while we're at it, poor Tony Atlas.
Oh, am I thinking? I'm thinking of the wrong guy. Sorry, not Outhouse. Yeah, Outhouse Jack.
Yeah, Outback Jack.
Yeah.
That was Kern, right?
No,
Kern. That was just some random dude from Australia. Kern was Skinner.
Skinner. That's all the same thing. Yeah, this is exactly what I'm talking about.
Exactly. You know, yeah, understood.
This hitting the peyote, and you know, this ends up as the result. You know, the Repo Man. You know, whole thing. It was awful. All right. What's the next?
And the WWF wondered why they became uncool in the early 90s.
This is exactly why ECW succeeded.
Yeah. Well, we've been over that before. Sean, what category would you like to discuss, sir?
I'm just feeling the negative, I got to tell you. Let's see. I am going to go I might as well get this out of the way. I'm going to go with most overrated. And anyone who's heard this show for any length of time knows exactly what I'm going to say. The most overrated wrestler would be one Bruiser Brody. Who is not the greatest thing since sliced bread, as the Observer would say.
I think right now he's top five underrated, because people had the backlash has been so strong.
Okay, we'll modulate it, but no, it was so ridiculous in the 80s. It was just so insane. It was, I'm like, Hanson did the same thing but better.
Yeah.
Well, okay, except he didn't get stabbed to death. That's the thing. It's like the Kurt Cobain thing where, okay, someone dies suddenly and they become overrated for a certain period of time. But we're past that period now, I think.
In 80s Brody, I think they just had a hard time finding the right guys for him to work with. At the Abdullah the Butcher thing they did to death. Well, that's kind of tasteless of me, not to death, but they did the Abdullah the Butcher thing, you know, the double count out and that whole thing. The matches he had with Jerry Blackwell, when Jerry Blackwell turned in he turned in the summer of 84 here in the AWA, and he was out for a while. So they had some matches in late 84 that were terrific. I think with Brody, they just had a hard time finding people that would work with him, because at the end of the day, he wasn't going to lay down for anybody. So
he did nothing for me. I'm sitting there looking at him. Then I'll look at Hanson. Like, I remember Hanson had a match in the AWA against Martel. It was this insane match outside. Hanson's like throwing the bell at people in the crowd. Yep. You know, they're charging after each other on the pitcher's mound. That's what I'm looking for. You know, between the comparison with Hanson, which is, you know, it's always there, he does not look good against, you know, Stan. Stan was just better.
I mean, you can make that argument. My, you know, the reason I don't feel that Brody is really in the overrated debate anymore is just no one has him on that pedestal that they had him in like 1988, 1989, et cetera. That's, you know, those days are over.
Well, in case they try to slip him back there again, I'm here.
All right. Brad, what are your thoughts? Most overrated wrestler of the 1980s.
Okay, here comes the mega heat. This choice is not so much overrated like, you know, he's thought of as in the middle and he was really at the bottom. This is just a guy that would probably be in a lot of people's top three, top four, top five. I think he's in my top 10, but we'll discuss that another day. But I'm going to say Ricky Steamboat.
Ooh.
If we get into this later, that's fine. My favorite Flair opponent, and, you know, when you talk about Ricky Steamboat, you've got 9 out of 10 people will say Steamboat Flair. I much preferred Windham and Flair. But Steamboat just never did anything for me. He was very bland, I thought. And, you know, his matches with Flair, of course, are legendary. Unfortunately, they came – I may have to plead ignorance on this because they were during the years where I had scaled back on watching a lot. I've seen all the matches since. But I think – I just don't think he was as great as a lot of people rate him in the top 3 or 5 of the decade.
Here's the problem with Ricky. I mean, did Bonnie kill him or what? Did that whole thing with Bonnie and that angle in 89 kill him? Because Ricky in, say, like 70, late 70s into early 80s was a different guy. He had kind of a different promo style. He was more fired up. That whole wholesome thing came a little bit later, and it really didn't fit him well.
Yeah. Little corner.
I agree, and one thing I will say about Ricky as a worker, a lot of the time his matches, he showed a lot of light on his offense, meaning that a lot of his offense looked fake, like that couldn't possibly hurt someone kind of thing. But when Steamboat was feuding with Flair, and I saw a few of the matches live, this is like 89 when they brought him in and they did the the Family Man gimmick. Ricky was booed every single time. And then they had him against Lex Luger, and you would think Lex Luger was Hulk Hogan. He was getting so many cheers, and he's the heel because of that gimmick. And here's the thing, you know, I saw Steamboat and Luger in Boston, and Steamboat got booed out of the building. I'd seen Ricky Steamboat in Boston before, and the fans were fine with him. So I agree with Sean that that gimmick just killed him dead.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess I'm speaking more of the gimmick. I mean, you really couldn't argue about his in-ring work, but the gimmick and just everything with that with that, and Flair just came off as so much more hip and.
Oh, it was cool. It was dead, and because I agree with Brett, because I always thought this too until I saw the thing with Sergeant Dawn. When he was starting to get angrier toward the end, I thought those promos. I was like, this is a different guy.
Yeah.
All right. Well,
agreed.
You can't call someone overrated without getting heat, because if you're overrated, that means a lot of people are going to like you. But before I get into my pick, every year in the Observer, Hulk Hogan got most overrated, and I always completely disagreed with that. I'm not sure what anyone could base that on. Yeah, he got a mega push, but he got over like no one had ever gotten over before on a national level. And he wasn't – I'm not saying he was Ric Flair, Ricky Morton in the ring, but he was always passable. So I just never understood that. But if I had to pick most overrated for the decade of the 1980s, it would be Rick Rude. I mean, people just made him out to be something that he wasn't, in my opinion. I thought he was a good worker, but not a great worker. They gave him a huge push, and he got over okay, but not great. You could argue that the business itself or the WWF business was falling behind, and you'd be right. But I just never saw him in that light, that superstar light that other people saw him in.
I didn't either. I didn't like the Chippendale gimmick, I guess, is what we were looking at, sort of. Well, maybe not so much, but yeah, the thing with Jake was pretty good, you know, early on, but he never did much for me. Rude did not.
I think you can give the same answer to Rude that Brad gave to Brody. I don't think anyone ever knew what to do with him.
I mean, WCW kind of did in the 90s.
That was the 90s, though, so.
Yeah, I mean, WWF got behind him, and, you know, they made him Intercontinental Champion. But, I mean, there are people who will say, oh, my God, I can't believe Rick Rude is not in the Observer Hall of Fame. And it's like, I can believe it because he's not a Hall of Famer.
Oh, yeah, if you're not bringing in Dick Murdoch, you're not bringing in him. No.
All right, my turn. Well, I am Mr. Positivity. Y'all know I'm Mr. Sunshine, so I'll bring it back to best. Best heel of the decade. I am going to go with Ted DiBiase, not just for what he did as the Million Dollar Man, although I thought that was one of the greatest gimmicks of all time, and he played it well, and he was really good in that gimmick. If he had just been the Million Dollar Man, I could still see him in the debate as far as, okay, was he the best heel of the decade? But his best work actually came in Mid-South Wrestling before he ever became the Million Dollar Man. Ted was just rotten to the core. He was just so dangerous. He had absolutely no conscience. Conscience is what I was trying to say. And he would take out another wrestler like the way I would take out a mosquito flying around my bedroom. Think nothing of it.
It's a Lester Banks
kind of that
answer.
Cold, calculated gimmick. Yeah, he did have that. I agree.
It's a Lester Banks answer. Because there's only one answer who the best heel is in the 80s is Rick.
Ric Flair.
Who's the man? Who else could there be? It had to be Rick.
That's my answer as well.
You guys think Ric Flair was the best heel? Wow.
Absolutely. Well, he was the best heel, best babyface, best whatever he wanted to be.
Yeah, you know, I think there was a big portion of the audience that, you know, the Horsemen were really looked at as kind of cool and not really traditional heels. But in the Carolinas, Flair, of course, was a babyface, first in the Starcade in 83, I believe, and that. But Flair, just for the longevity from 1981 to 1989, I think, because there's so many guys that only qualify for some of these things on a half a decade's worth or 4 or 5, 6 years. But Flair, from top to bottom of the decade, I think is the best heel as well. I agree.
It's just one of those things. He is just so – I mean, I have him – you have like 500 questions here, and I have him in about 150 of them. He was just so great in that decade that you can pretty much give him the answer that's the best almost everything.
Yeah.
I mean, Ric Flair is my favorite wrestler of all time. And when you brought him up as best heel, what I tried to do is put aside the JCP stuff where it was obvious they were not really trying to get people to hate Flair, or if they were, they were doing a terrible job. I'm like, you know, moving back to like when he was in Mid-South, when he was in World Class, when he was in Florida, and to me, he was always a hard guy to hate. Now, is that important? I think it's important. It's not the only thing, but I think you want – if you're going to call someone best heel, you've got to have someone that the fans hated. And I don't even think the fans in Dallas really hated Ric Flair.
Mm-mm.
They might have hated him for 40 minutes when he was against Kerry, but that's it.
Yeah, no matter what territory you got, NWA, you know, with the NWA existed – whatever territory it was, when Flair was in Portland, when Flair was in, in the Carolinas, when Flair was in Texas or Florida, for that matter, you knew you were going to get a great match. You could get a great match out of anybody.
Yeah, literally anybody. There was no such thing as a bad Flair match in the 80s.
Yeah. In Florida, I think they threw a couple curveballs at him because Dusty was upset at one time. I don't know if any of you remember that, but right after he regained the belt, I think for the second time, I think Dusty took off or something. But that's neither here nor there in the question.
You know what? I want to take back something I said. At the very end of 1989, I think it was like December 18th or December 20th, something like that. So we're at the very, very end of the decade. I went down to New Haven and saw a very bad Ric Flair versus Great Muda match. Uh-huh. And one of the guys was like, you know, oh, yeah, it's a Sunday night show and they've been on the road and they're looking forward to going home. It was actually a Sunday afternoon show. And, you know, they're tired and they just want to go home. I'm like, I just drove 2.5, 3 hours to come see this show. And these guys, you know, were just not interested in performing. And not just Flair and Muda. Like, no one was interested in putting on a good show on that night.
Yeah. Hey, who knows what kind of weekend those boys had?
Oh, yeah. Especially, when they've been on the road for a while. Sometimes it's time to go home.
As someone who's been who bought me a Long Island iced tea one time, I know Ric Flair was living the gimmick.
Oh, we've talked about this. I actually shared my best Ric Flair show story on one of the 605 specials that came out right after Rick had done his 30 for 30 thing. And I can tell you, Rick definitely lived the gimmick.
Yep. Yep. I was in the bathroom next to him taking a leak one time. And I said, Mr. Flair, I really enjoy your work. He says, hey, all right, let's get this guy at Long Island.
Yeah. That sounds like Flair.
He said, all right, I appreciate that. The big smile with his snaggle tooth. But he wasn't acting. He wasn't, this is what he was.
Yeah, I saw him in Philadelphia one time. We were talking on a recent show about me getting my picture taken with Dusty Rhodes, and the picture barely came out. Like that same night, I got a picture with Ric Flair, and it didn't come out at all. But he and I were hanging out probably like literally 40 minutes just talking Lakers Celtics. I like knew which direction to go in.
Oh, that sounds like a good time. Absolutely.
It was excellent.
I'm sure. Awesome. Yeah. I didn't get a chance to really talk to him very many times, but you know, a little bit. And in the bathroom, you know, you're limited.
All right. Well, we're definitely rolling. Brad Breitzman, excuse me. Can you tell us what our next category is going to be?
I can do that, and it's kind of getting away from the negativity a little bit, which is kind of our forte tonight, apparently.
Apparently.
The biggest shock of the decade. Now, this is a decade that is full of shocks. I mean,
yeah, really.
Unless you're, you know, a younger person and missed it, you just never know what was going to happen, especially as the mid part of the decade came around. I remember feeling so disheartened when I would see guys just pop up on WWF television that had been plucked from territories. But my biggest shock of the decade for me, you could say Black Saturday, you know, of course, but the biggest shock of the decade for me was seeing Buzz Sawyer on WWF TV as Bulldog Buzz Sawyer. That was just something you knew wasn't going to fly.
Now, why was that shocking to you?
Well, this is right after he had turned babyface in Georgia, and then that wasn't working out apparently, and then they sent him to Florida to be with Sullivan, and it was right in the middle of his run with Sullivan, and all of a sudden he just showed up for one taping, and they had him on their weekly TV show. From seeing Buzz on Georgia as often as I did every week, you just knew that Buzz was a bit of a loose cannon.
Yeah.
I want to say. And I just didn't see him being a good fit, especially with his, you know, with his physique. And he certainly wasn't going to go after Hogan. I don't know what they would have done with him, but that was my biggest shock, is to see Buzz Sawyer. And I was shocked seeing plenty of guys show up on their television out of nowhere. But that was the biggest one for me.
All right. You know what? And to me, you know, and it's about different opinions. I remember when that happened, I didn't feel especially shocked because it looked like, you know, I didn't know what was happening behind the scenes in wrestling, but it certainly looked like Vince McMahon was out to hire pretty much everyone.
Yeah.
So I can't say that, you know, Buzz really stood out for me. But you know, like I said, it's about opinion. Sean, biggest shock of the 80s for you?
I'm going to punt on this one to you, John. Come back to me. I'm still kind of deciding.
Okay. I would say my biggest shock of the decade was when Gino Hernandez died. Here's someone who I'd always been a huge fan of, and now he had been on World Class TV since – you know, summer of 84. I think he showed up in June when they aired the Parade of Champions show. And, you know, the guy was just there every week. And then, you know, one day I get a call from someone, February 86, that he read in USA Today that, you know, Gino Hernandez had died. And, you know, when that happens, you kind of like hold out hope that they're wrong or that it's a different Gino Hernandez. I don't know. And then World Class came on that week and they announced that he had died.
Was he the first one in World Class? I mean, it's tragic news. I mean, the way that everything did play out down there in Dallas, but was he the first one from World Class to actually pass away? I believe he was.
David.
Oh, David was right. David in Japan. That's correct. Okay,
yeah,
but Gino was the first of a line of many to come.
Yeah, and, you know,
after David.
I know people who lived down there, know, when, you know, stuff was going on before David died. You know, you just hear weird things about what was going on with the Von Erichs, and then David died. And when Mike died, I guess, you know, collectively the community was like, you know, what is going on with these guys? And that really led to, I mean, the downward spiral was already happening for that promotion, but that hastened it.
Yeah.
I would say David dying. Because even by Gino was a good one, but even by Gino, there was kind of still an aura. They were starting to pick up an aura in Dallas.
David was a shock.
And that was, I mean, and they kept everything so quiet that, as you said, that came out of the thin blue air.
Yeah, and, you know, there are all kinds of stories about what actually happened with David, but, you know, I mean, put it this way, the one thing I do know is that they got him in the ground before anything could be I don't think they ever did an autopsy. They just buried him and that was it.
They sure did. They sure did. And what was it? What was the aftermath of acute enteritis?
I believe that was exactly it. He died in his sleep due to that.
Wasn't it Brody who threw away the drugs, supposedly?
Yep.
I heard story that it was Brody and Chavo that cleaned up the room. I'm not sure if that story is true or not, but that's what I heard.
But that's a big reason why it was so shocking, because they buried stuff in Dallas. That you never heard anything, just because they had everything so tightly under wraps.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, when I was, you know, when I first started getting the Observer at the end of 86, it was probably early 87 that I first found out that, you know, David didn't just die because he got kicked in the stomach in Japan. He hadn't even wrestled there yet.
No. No, I don't think that's what happened at all. But that was the company line. If I could ask a real quick question to both of you.
Sure.
Just off the beaten path for a second. John just mentioned the Observer in late 86. I'm wondering, I know when I got my first Observer in the mail was springtime in 86. And John, you were late in 86 when you got your first issue?
I came home from a Christmas party and they were three of them. And it was like I found the Holy Grail.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. How about you, Sean? When did you pluck your first one of those out of the mailbox?
Probably looking at 94, okay, when I started, because that's when I left and I came back, and that was mostly ECW at that point. So they always kind of encouraged that behind the scenes thing. So yeah, that kind of went with it. It was just a different change of attitude as a fan.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, guys. I was just curious as to when your dates were on those, because yeah, it did change everything if you were a fan for certain.
Oh, I've told this story before. I was at a Christmas party in Boston, not around Boston, in the city. I drive home. I get home. It's like 3:30, something like that.
Yeah.
And I was up until long past sunrise reading these things.
Yeah. And they were so dense, and they were just so great. And handing one of those off to a kid I met at a wrestling show, who turned out to be Wade Keller, who got a little spark put in his head from that. But
that's some cool history, man. I had no idea.
Yeah, I was the original. I didn't really do anything, but I was the original assistant editor of the Torch in 87. I really didn't do anything. Wade did everything. He still continues to, but that's going back a ways. I was in my teens then, 19 or something. Okay, thanks, guys. I'm just curious.
It was the first wrestling publication that didn't insult your intelligence.
Yeah.
Way ahead of After.
I didn't have access to that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wrestling.
Yeah, one of these days we're gonna have to have Brad on and just talk about Brad.
True.
No, he's seriously, man. He's got an interesting story. But anyway, Sean, you may select the next category.
Well, I can't see that there's going to be a ton of debate here, but let's go with worst announcer, because, you know, I have no desire to, you know, leave in this wonderful negative cocoon. So worst announcer, I can't see how there's going to be a lot of debate here. It's Bill Mercer, right?
There were so many bad announcers in the 1980s that, I mean, you could have a football team with them.
Yes,
like
and Bill
55
Mercer
guys.
Still- He clearly didn't want to be there. It was obvious he didn't want to be there, and he thought this was beneath him.
That's true.
He made Mark Lawrence look like a superstar just because he was that much better in comparison to him.
And you know what? As bad as Mercer was, and you're right, you know, I mean, he was sleepwalking sometimes.
He was offensive. He basically he looked at this as his insult on his great intelligence. Oh, yeah, by the way, I called the ice bowl on radio 500 years ago.
Kennedy assassination, too, I think he did.
Yeah.
He did.
Yeah.
So here's a guy, he's a professor, I believe, at North Texas State University. He's a serious news broadcaster, and he's doing pro wrestling. And you're right. He definitely conveyed that he was above this.
So I thought he was terrible, but I
can definitely name worse.
So it was Lance Russell. Lance Russell did the same thing, and he was never condescending for 1 minute.
That is true.
Yeah.
All right, Brad, what would be your pick for the worst TV announcer of the 1980s?
Gino.
He was awful.
Gorilla Monsoon. Especially some of those Toronto tapes that were hardly, you know, watchable. And just the pompous, arrogant sort of, you know, come across. I guess he was a great guy who everyone loved. And I understand that. That's not what we're talking about. But as an announcer, I didn't care for him at all. I thought he was the worst.
He was so bad. And you could tell – it's always been my theory that he would say stuff like, you know, literally hanging off the rafters. He was an educated man, and mm-hmm. I think he did that on purpose because he was one of the longtime Carney guys who saw wrestling fans as the biggest rubes in the world who were willing to pay money and go to the matches and get excited about this obviously fake stuff. And I think that just carried on into his announcing.
I have two things with Gino. One is that it depends. If he was with Heenan or he was with Ventura, he was fine.
Yeah.
But anybody else, that helped him a lot. The other was, I look at Gino just like I look at Oakland. You know, the two old Carnies and, you know, the whole kind of, you know, act. It almost like they're kind of winking at you the whole time while they're doing it.
Yeah. I got Oakland down as my best announcer, and I know we're not supposed to jump out of order, but yeah, especially when Gene went to WWF, he became a carnival barker, but I think his stuff in the AWA was pretty hilarious and campy.
But he was a good carnival barker.
Yes.
I don't know. I mean, I remember when he first showed up, January 1984, and we were all like, who is this guy and what is he doing? Boston Garden, Causeway Street, Saturday night. And we're like, get out of here.
And that's what Dean would say. Get out of here.
Gentlemen, please.
What's wrong with you? Please.
Gentlemen, please.
Wasn't he the one who swore on the air by accident or something?
I think that was Vince, wasn't it?
I thought that was
it was Oakland. Yes, it was.
It's been done before. Patterson did it once.
And Oakland's the only one who could have made, like, he was the best part of what was the gobbledygooker bit?
I don't think there was a good part of that bit.
He's Carney. He's, you know, he's a carnival. But it reminds me of, you know, they asked a question of one of those lawyers you see on TV. And they said, you're in the ambulance station. The lawyer said, yeah, but I'm a good one. That's Gene. Gene knows what he is. He's a carnival barker. I'm a fan. If I don't sound like I'm a fan, I am a fan.
Have you guys ever seen the clip where the Far East West Connection are kind of introduced on AWA TV?
I saw it a long time ago, but I remember it.
Saito comes out with a kimono and gives it to Jesse, and he puts it on. And he says, the presentation of that all-silk smoking jacket. And Saito says, no, it's not smoking jacket. It's kimono. He said, kimono. One of my favorite Camp Oakland moments.
Gene belonged in vaudeville somewhere.
Yes.
He got there in the WWF.
Yes. He's an old school Carney, and I mean, I'm a fan. I do like him. I see why you don't like him, but you have to be kind of get the joke.
No, yeah. I get it. I mean, you know, I was the guy who wanted the WWF to be more like Mid-South wrestling, and it was never going to be.
Right, exactly. They had the guys, they had the boys, and the females for that matter, too. They had the people, they had the talent, but it just never was booked in a really intriguing way as far as I was concerned.
I hear you.
Yeah.
So anyway, before I give you mine, because we're like running out of time, but we have like just enough time, I think, to do this. And then, you know, for me to tell the story and then give my worst announcer. Did you guys know what like the story behind the gobbledygooker was? It was not supposed to be a dancing turkey chicken thing coming out of the egg. They were originally going to have the Undertaker in the egg, and he was going to come like kicking and stomping his way out of the thing, and that was going to be his introduction. And they backed out, I want to say last minute, but they backed out because they were afraid like every little kid watching the show at home was going to shit his pants.
Mm. So they turned it into a chicken.
They turned it into a comedy bit. They're like, okay, we can't, you know, have Undertaker burst out of this egg like they had originally planned. So they're like, and they built up the what's in the egg thing. So that's how it ended.
I'm going to be completely awkwardly honest here. This must have been 88, 89. I've never seen a gobbledygooker clip.
It's okay, man. It's okay that you've never seen that.
I'm probably just as good, just as well off having not seen it.
It's more important that you go see the Shockmaster crashing through the wall.
Oh, that I've seen.
Yes, that is or either that or Morocco, Lou Albano slipping on Morocco's meatball.
Oh, yeah. Man. All right. Worst announcer of the decade in the 80s. And there are so many to choose from. I'm going to go one and two. Number two, and it can easily be argued that he's number one, is Ed Whalen. Ed Whalen was spectacularly bad.
Oh, I have to change my answer. I hate Ed.
I mean, he would sit there and he was Oakland at his worst, but even worse than Oakland. I mean, he would sit there and openly laugh at the product.
Oh, no, no. Yeah, but Gene was kind of playing along. Ed was just – Ed killed angles. They had a great angle. They had a great angle with Stomper against Bad News Allen, where they did the thing with Stomper's kid and a pile drive Archie Gouldy.
Yep.
Uh-huh.
And it was too much for old Ed, and he got the show taken off the air because of that. It was a white hot angle; he killed it dead. I hate Ed.
But I
remember Hashimoto was kicking a guy too hard, and Ed just told him to cut the tape. Just like, cut this crap. No, we're not using it.
Was he smartened up? I mean, he was smartened up, but I mean, did they let him know what was going down? I mean, I don't really know. I don't have Calgary knowledge.
Ed needed a trip down the dungeon.
Yeah.
But the thing was,
that would have fixed him.
Ed was he was almost like Lance Russell's evil twin in that he had all kinds of pull with the television stations, and he had all kinds of pull with the Athletic Commission as well, and that was a big deal in Calgary.
Right. He was like, if Gene Okerlund and Bill Mercer had some evil spawn, it'd be Ed Whalen.
There you go. And he wasn't even my worst. And I, you know what? I'm thinking about it. And I have two announcers that were worse than Ed Whalen. Mike McGurk. Have you ever heard her?
Yes. No arguments.
Brad's like me. I'm ashamed to have heard her as well. But number one, coast to coast, border to border, Honolulu to wherever, Maine to some other state, that Maine to Montana. The guy who would before the Nick Bockwinkel Kurt Hennig match from that aired at the very end of 1986 started thanking every single person in the production crew, thus giving away the fact that they were going to go an hour. And that is none other than Rod Trongard. I cannot think of anyone worse than him.
I was talking to Cerruti, Kevin Cerruti, about this last night, and we both agreed that he was okay, like, calling an arena match by himself, like, you know, the Blackwell turn type of thing. But yeah, Rod Trongard was pretty rough. He was the announcer for the St. Paul Fighting Saints hockey team in the 1970s.
Did not know that.
Yeah, he had a background, then he worked for the North Stars after that, and then he turned up on AWA TV. But yeah, Rod Trongard was rough at times, for sure.
Rod was bad, but he was just bad. I mean, he tried, he just wasn't very good.
And that look he cultivated was crazy, too. That was with the perm and the glasses.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, but that look was definitely something else. I got to give him credit for that.
Yeah. Ed was bad and got in the way.
Exactly. And, you know, there are so many that we haven't even talked about. I mean, David Crockett. Good God.
How many announcers can you think of have gotten your own product taken off the air?
That's a good point.
One.
That is a really good point.
We'll
but
call
anyway,
this now forever the Ed Whalen Worst Announcer Award.
You know what, though? There are so many bad announcers that Ed doesn't even stand out that you could give the name the award after him. I mean,
he's
there are guys we haven't even mentioned.
Taken off the air. That's as bad as it gets. You're the announcer for your show, and you get to take it off the air.
That is pretty bad. I've got a – you know what? I'll throw out a controversial one.
Yeah.
After, like, let's say middle of 1982, Gordon Solie was terrible. I am sorry.
He was.
I also think he looks worse in comparison to what he used to be. Like, the fall off was so dramatic.
I watched him every week on TBS, and I never, ever got the notion that Gordon had a bottle in the podium. But he did, apparently.
Yeah. Oh, by 1983, that started becoming obvious.
Yeah, a little bit.
Star Trek, it's hard to watch.
Yeah, you know, I probably should go back and check that out. Yeah, I think you're right. I think about that time period.
Well, the thing with Gordon is, like, in 83 – the magazines or the after magazines had decided that they all hated Vince McMahon and wanted to party with Georgia Championship Wrestling, and they promoted Gordon Solie like he was Vince Scully. Yep. And I would watch the TV and be like, what am I watching here? He doesn't even know the names of the two guys who are getting beat up by the Road Warriors.
Yeah, that's the story on that after thing with Gordon Solie and getting in bed with NWA everywhere. Is that apparently Vince called up after and told him that he wanted him to take over his WWF exclusive, and after told him to go to hell or whatever. And so then all of a sudden there was no coverage because they wouldn't give him photography rights at ringside. And so they would just started putting the results in the middle part of the magazine as a clever way to kind of cover the WWF. But it was pretty obvious that something had gone down.
Yeah, by 85, they were printing every WWF result they could get, and I believe the idea behind it was to show the fans that the WWF was running the exact same show, or close to the exact same show in every town.
Exactly.
But anyway, pleasant surprise for all of our Stick to Wrestling listeners, Brad Breitzman is going to be back next week. We are wrapping up this show. Next week, we plan on doing the top 10 wrestlers of the 1980s, and whoever gets number one between the three of us is going to be the winner of the 2018 Sticky Award. So thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
And everyone – oh, that's right. Christmas is right around the corner. I hope everyone has a great holiday. And this has been a broadcast of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Our producer is Lou Kippelman. Lou, thank you for the work you do. Everyone have a good week.